session number 16344, Reel 3.
Mr. McDonough, Reel 3.
Yes, some of the German soldiers would dress up in civilian clothes. And on this particular farm, we was rooting around, and I saw this man who looked about 40-ish and approached him and asked him, soldier. He said, no. Now, the lady who mustn't have known this man, only that he'd told her to keep her mouth shut, was waving behind him that he was. So in turn, I told some of the men to just take charge of him while she showed me into this bedroom. In the bedroom, underneath the bed, was his uniform, and he was a high-ranking party man, which is the, you know, the brown with the eagle and swastika, you know, like Hitler wore. Well, I've the uniform, the jacket I have. So I brought out this and told all the other chaps, the other prisoners which we had, was redirected with this man then to the prison camp, the Afghan. Because that day, as we were proceeding along, there was that many prisoners that we could not afford to take prisoners, and there was just and signs was put up pointing to prison camp. And all these men, there was hundreds of people as we went along, hundreds of German soldiers who'd just thrown the rifles away, they've had enough, and they was all marching, following the signs to the prison camp. And that's the only way we could deal with the biggest weight of them. We couldn't do any other. So from that area, we proceeded along to, was it Osnabrück? There's places in between, I can't just remember, unless I was looking at something. But Osnabrück, we were all around those areas, cleared all the areas where possible, and in turn, it became that there was thousands of German soldiers all just wanting to, they'd had enough, in other words, they didn't want no problem whatsoever. So from there, we went right along up to the Baltic coast, a place called Wismar, which is W-I-S-M-A-R, Wismar, or Wismar. And it was on the right on the Baltic coast. And we, as we were approaching a wood from another copse, we could see some tanks hidden in behind the woods. So we spread out and run across the field. I can remember it just distinctly. But previous to that, we used a monocular, which is a one side of a binocular type of thing, and we could see that there was, beside the tank, there was people there. But being very careful, in case there was Germans wanting to sacrifice their lives, could have been SS panzers, anything, we couldn't tell. So we diverted and just dodged around till we got over to the tanks, and coming in from the edge of the wood, we found out that these was Russian troops. So in turn, we was amongst the first to meet these Russian troops, which some of the lads was that excited, doing a bit of swearing here and there, and all of a sudden one of these, this Russian officer, who we thought was, when she pulled the helmet off, it was a woman major. She was in charge of the tanks. There was about five tanks there. And so they had this bottle of vodka, which they give the lads a drink of this vodka. And I think that, as far as we were concerned, more or less one point towards the edge of the war, as far as we were concerned. We went back then to Wismar, where we was having to stay in rough ground. But we was told that some of the people in the Wismar, where the houses were, these big houses, were having to leave so that we could get billeted for the time being, because some of the troops had been killed in one house by some troops who had been dressed as civilians. So this house in Wismar, which I've got photograph of, we stayed there. And on this certain night, some of the lads got it on the radio that the war was over, which nobody told us, because we were still scouting around into the area of Wismar itself, the town, seeing if there's anybody around there. So we hadn't, while they were all celebrating, perhaps back in England, we hadn't even got a bottle of beer or a can of beer to celebrate. So do you want me to say this part?
Yes.
So one of the officers, Lockie, who now lives in Australia, and Ensherwood, who lives in Scotland, said, well, I'm sure that Mac, which we had nicknames, well, Mac's easy for me, and Davis, that's Dave, would take a jeep and go and find something somewhere. So what we did, we set off down into Wismar, and looking round, of course, everywhere was empty and the shops was nothing in the shops. Then all of a sudden we heard this singing, Russian singing. It sounded like Russian to us. So when we went down towards this area where the singing was and went down a few steps into a cellar, we found that there were these great big barrels and five Russians with some candles sat around. They were Mongolians, which was the... they used the Mongolians as an advance party so that the best soldiers didn't get killed, you see. Oh, yeah, they did that. So we just said Ruski Anglais, offered cigarettes, and they offered this drink. Well, when we had a taste of it, it tasted like brandy to us. So I thought, well, we must have some of this because that's what they've sent us for, you see. But we hadn't got a bucket. So anyway, one of the lads went into a shop and tried to take the globe down. Unfortunately, he broke it with his revolver and it was no good. So I thought, well, we must have the bucket. So we got the bucket off the Russians. I won't say how we got it, but we got it anyway, off these Mongolians. And so that was the only celebration that we managed to get for the rest of the men from the 591 lot. So from then on, of course, our job was just routine then, knowing full well that we had nothing really to worry about. The only thing was that these Mongolians caused trouble in the town. There was no lights, and we were just doing a guard duty this night near where there was these flats. It was kind of high, not like they are today, but pretty high up, these flats. And all of a sudden, there was a woman jumped through the window, killed her, of course, from that height. And when we run in, these Mongolians were trying to rape the women, and so we had to deal with them. Anyway, the German people in that block thanked us very much, and one lady took us up to her flat to show her what she'd done. And she had a daughter about 14. And so that they didn't know that she had a daughter, she'd put her in one of the wardrobes. So, and she'd run out to let them chase her, in other words, you see. And so she was so grateful. But you could tell who lived in the flats because they always had a plate outside, you see, with the name on, Air or Madam or whatever, you know, Frau rather, or Fraulein, you see, on the outside there. So they were so grateful. So at least we didn't have no problem with the German people in that area after that, for what time we was there.
How did you stop the Mongolians?
No, well, they was going to shoot us, you see, because they knew that they'd done wrong. And there was a load of rabble anyway, because what they were doing was wrong. It was only giving our troops a bad name as well. So there was actually, we saw two, and the third one, he was that terrified that he just jumped straight through the window like the woman who they tried to attack did. So that was the end of their problem. But there was scruff, you know, there was real scruff, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
they fired, when we was going up the steps, what started it off, they fired down the steps, thinking we were coming to shoot them, we were going to stop them. But with them firing, of course, you return fire, you don't. There's no arguing about that, is there, let's face it. So anyway, we reported it when we got back, and we were told, well, just forget about it, that's fair enough, you know. Anyway, the lady in particular with the girl, the daughter at 14, came up to our where we was and asked for officer in charge to say that she was so grateful what had happened, you know. And so the other woman who it had killed jumping out before let them touch her, well, then they buried her just before we left that area, yeah.
So you had to shoot the two Mongolians?
That's right, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the other one jumped to
his death?
The other kid
committed suicide himself, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Actually, we didn't want to do that. We wanted to take them back with us. We didn't know their officer, and we weren't interested to take them back to our officers to show them, to tell them what had happened. So it ended it to, as far as we were concerned, that was the end of it. So from then on, of course, well, It was just a matter of being prepared, ready to get back, to come back home. So what we did then, we was going to Lunenburg airfield and taking off from there to come back home, thinking we'd completed everything and that'd be the end of the war for us. But at Lunenburg airfield, which I have a photograph of the Dakota which was going on, I was detailed off to, instead of coming straight home, I had to, we captured two German motor torpedo boats. So the idea was that we had to bring them back to England, which would be very valuable for training at RE water camps, you know, for watermanship, which we'd already been trained back home in England, up in Yorkshire and down at Lyme Regis. And so that's what we did. We brought them back to Ostend. One of them, the tyres burst, so we had to ditch that on the way back, but we brought one back anyway. The tyres on the trailer, on the motor torpedo boat. There was on big, massive trailer, because a motor torpedo boat is a fair weight, you know. So the tyre had burst, and luckily it didn't turn the vehicle over, which were towing it. So we had to ditch that one. But the other one was brought back to Ostend and then diverted to some place, I don't know, back in England. So from then we went back home, we got back home, and we was given, that's when I got married actually, when we come back home. And but they told us then that we hadn't finished at all, that we was going out to the Far East with the 5th Brigade as an independent parachute brigade to drop on Changi airfield and capture it and release the prisoners from Changi jail. Which by the time we got there, the drop wasn't required. They just brought us in by sea and took over Changi jail, released the prisoners, and there was a race course over the Johor Bridge, the causeway, and it was called the Booker Tema race course, just off the Booker Tema Road. And that's where we had hundreds of Japanese which had been captured, but we got all the tradesmen out of this by the Japanese officers who spoke English, to tell them we wanted all the tradesmen, electrician, John, blah, blah, blah. And they was going to make the camp for these poor lads who were in such a terrible condition, they had to carry a lot of them. And there was a hospital ship down in the harbour at Singapore for the ones who was really ill, you know, who couldn't walk at all. So up at the Booker Tema race course, all these huts was made, and there was medical staff in attendance to help all these lads who'd been prisoners there, and to bring them back to reality, because they couldn't feed them as we were being fed because their stomachs had shrunk. So it was just a matter of a period of time before they could take them then to the hospital ship, some of them. So from then on,
what job were you doing at the Booker Tema race course?
Well, we had to organise these, which were tradesmen, into what we wanted doing for the men who were ill. In other words, telling them exactly what... Some of our men were tradesmen, so they were detailed off to tell them exactly what we wanted through the interpretation of the Japanese officers who could speak a percentage of English. And anything at all which would help, because it had to be done as fast as possible, because some of these lads were already... They were in such a bad way, you know. And then, of course, the ones who was committed crimes, these officers, were taken to Changi jail, the Japanese officers, were committed to trial there to be hung. But they demanded, and there was a Sikh and a little Malayan who hung them, and they demanded, these Japanese officers, that they should be shot. It was dishonourable to be hung. So that was arranged by a firing squad from certain battalions. So from there on, of course, we were then stationed at Raffles College. To all the rest of these Japanese officers had to be guarded until the crimes was qualified as to whether they'd be shot or whatever. So from then on, after that was over, We were shown different things, cruelty, what they'd done to these lads, because at Raffles College they had a place there where they used to torture them, and that was, they used to hose pipe them, in other words, put hose pipe in and blow the stomach up with water and then beat them. Well, all this was taken down and used for evidence against when there was at this special court, but we didn't see the court, wherever it was, you know. So from then on, we what was after that now? Oh yes, they transferred us then to a we had to separate from different units then, and we went to a place called Nanyang Girls' School. And that was to fit our squadron in as a unit. So from then on, there wasn't very much to do at the time, only just round different people if there was anywhere about. Then a request came through from Netherlands East Indies in Java that the Japanese troops there were a Kempeitai as well. They weren't handing in their arms. And so there was a request for the 5th Brigade to go to Java, of which we did. And the first place we went to was Batavia in Java. And there was fighting in and around when we got there. With the Dutch had no idea at all of anything other than a rifle. They'd never been trained to fire machine guns or mortars or anything like that. So some of our people then was there to train them how to fire them, and then we had to put a tax into these Japanese people who was robbing, raping, looting, burning. They were doing just what they wanted.
Japanese?
The Japanese, that were, yeah. This was in Java. So anyway, to finish the story on that part, the highest rank officer, Japanese, was told by our officers that the men, some had handed their arms in, so they were prisoners. And the others, he was told that his men would be given the job of trying to get back the arms of his men who disobeyed his orders. To a Japanese officer, if anybody disobeys his orders, it's not like ours, he would be executed. He'd be classed as a traitor. So he knew that it was very important that he had to get his honour back by his men not obeying the orders. He'd given them orders to hand the weapons in, you see. So, not a lot knows this, but they was given the job without weapons, the ones who'd handed the arms in, to retrieve what they could and attack their own men. And they got about, I think it was 75 to 80% of the weapons back, and the rest of them who wouldn't, they were destroyed. And how they got them back, they made spears and bows and arrows out of bamboo. That's the only weapons they could have, the ones who we'd told to attack their own men. So to us, that was something. And it's not in a book yet, but I believe there's a book somewhere where it's about the only enemy who's ever helped the other troops to do something when the war was on. So that's something to be thought about and all, isn't it?
This was in Batavia?
That was in Batavia. And then from Batavia we went to Semarang. That's further up the coast. And the trouble then had kind of quelled a little, but there was still some in that area which was they were seen of. But the only thing they was frightened of in Semarang then, they couldn't get no lights going. So any engineer who was qualified on diesels, they had a big diesel unit for electricity. So, as it happens, a destroyer pulled a lot into Semarang, and some of the naval men who was used to these big engines, diesel, were brought up to help get the lights going, to give the people confidence, you see. We had to get the confidence of the Dutch people and the Javanese people, because when we first went there, some of the Dutch people said, oh, these paramen are like the French Foreign Legion, the convicts and all that, which our colonel made them apologise openly in a letter that it wasn't so. So anyway, they came and got the lights going. But our main job was protecting a reservoir. which was they was frightened that the, what were left they might poison the water in them areas, which it didn't come off anyway. So those had to be guarded heavily. After that, the general thing was, getting back to what I said, that getting the confidence of the people and the Chinese people. Some Chinese people have buried all their jewellery and gold in the ground, and when it come to find it, they couldn't find it. So having mine detectors, we was given the job of helping to find their... and which that, the Chinese people in those areas couldn't say enough about us. Oh, and after this, after these people who said about there was convicts in the Paris and all like that, it was so disgusting. But anyway, their head man, whoever he was, the Dutchman, there was all information sent out to our lot. And each Dutch house, because some were pretty wealthy, there was invite for so many Paris to come and have tea with them whenever they could come and have a meal with them as a recompense for the wrongdoing that they'd said. And so they became very good friends of us. As a matter of fact, before I left, I was about the only one to first get a German automatic Colt, which held 14 rounds in the magazine. They have them today, Browning's they call, and there was always a 4 or 5 we had, which only held 7, one in the spout. So the actual thing was, when I first got it in Germany, I noticed that the butt was pretty thick, broad, and that's how it was done. Instead of the bullets coming down like that, they came down like that. So it held 14 rounds in the mag. Now, one of the people who we got to know, our section, our stick, this Dutchman, he had a family, and he was frightened that when we was leaving, that if there was any strays might come round, he had no weapons. So he asked, could he buy this off me? And I didn't want to part with it, actually, because there were nobody else in the mob had one. So I let him have it, and I left him 1,000 9mm rounds, and he couldn't thank me enough because he was so terrified he couldn't get a weapon from nowhere in case there was an odd stray come to affect his family.
An odd stray?
Yes, a stray Japanese or, you know, which there's always odd ones who's floated off. So I thought we did a good turn there. So from then on, there was more to it than that, but I can't just think of anything more on that situation now.
Did you ever come across any of the Javanese nationalists who wanted to...
Not in them days, no. They may have been there. The only thing that we had problem was with the... There was a Japanese medical stores, which there were thousands of pounds worth of medical equipment, and it was there was a river run through Batavia, you see, right down. It was used as everything, washing and or whatever, you know. And across this river, more or less like a canal it was running through the town, there was this big medical stores, which we had to guard in case we needed that equipment. We could use some of that medical equipment. It's a big warehouse, thousands of pounds worth of it. But at night, these natives used to come across a bridge at the far end, and they'd have nothing on, only just they had like a kris. I don't know what you know what a kris is. Well, it's all jagged, and they put it in the scabbard, and that takes poison into it, into these cutouts. And if they cut you with it, well, you're as good as dead in no time. And they used to come across with nothing on, as you couldn't tell in the dark. And they was trying to get into the medical stores, and we had to sort all them out. So whether or not they were that type, I wouldn't know. We wasn't really interested, as long as everything was running under control, you know.
Were they trying to get drugs?
Yeah, they were trying to get into this store, but I don't know whether I should say this. Do you want to just...
Well, why not say it?
Well, what it was... The old man said, well, we'll have to deal with this, but we didn't know where they was coming from. We couldn't chase them back. So what we had between the men, we had an idea like this. Said, well, tonight, what we'll do, the ones on guard, because the 12th Battalion were further down, said, ensure that you're out of sight. Make sure you can see them coming over the bridge. Make sure you can see them coming along the wall, because in the dark, you know, which we did, leave the stores open, the door of the stores, medical stores, slightly, make sure they go inside, then go inside and chase them out. And the reason that we had to chase them out was, as they didn't go back over the bridge, that they dived into the canal to get away. But that night, as everyone knew, the canal was down. So the rest of it was sludge about this deep, you see. So when they was chased out, of course they come running out to dive into the canal to get away. And of course the next day, there were so many legs sticking out of the sludge, which meant we didn't have to do anything, they did it themselves. So that we never saw any more of those after. So whether the message got back, I don't know. But they was left there anyway. Barring but when the tide came in or whatever, of course, then it released later on and may have took them away. Because they used to send different things down, you know. If they killed anybody, some of these, they'd put them on a raft and put them to let you know that they'd done it, you see. And it had come down this river, well, canal type it was, coming through this town in Batavia.
With a dead body on
it. Oh, yeah, yeah. So they wasn't nice people to know, so you had to treat them just the same, you see. So in that area then, things became, as everybody was happy, the shops started to open, which was all empty, little shops. We even put a display on, which I showed you previously, for...
A display of what?
Well, this is the one. There was a parade to give the people more confidence in Semarang. There was a parade ordered for a march past of the 5th Parachute Brigade on the 30th of March 1946 to mark the first anniversary of the airborne crossing of the River Rhine. The commander were Brigadier Darling, DSO, and the salute would be taken by the Commander-in-Chief Allied Forces, Netherlands, East Indies, Lieutenant General Sir MGM Stopford, KBE, CB, DSO and MC. And that was done also specially to give the people real confidence, and it was to commemorate anyway the crossing of the River Rhine. So at that period in time, things had slowed down in that area of Semarang, more or less as peace and quiet had come to the area, and the Dutch troops had been trained by us to be able to handle more heavier weapons. So we thought then we might be coming back home, but apparently not. We were shipped back to Palestine to rejoin the 6th Airborne Division in Palestine, where there was problems with the Jewish people and Arab people, you name it was all going on at that time.
And you were still with the same unit?
The 3rd Parachute Squadron it was, yes. Because I was with 591 in Normandy, straight through to the Ardennes, the crossing of the Rhine, and then after the crossing of the Rhine, of course, there was that many men lost with the 591 and 3rd Paris Squadron that we amalgamated, and we was called the 3rd Parachute Squadron RE then.
Which year did you go to Palestine? 46 or 47?
It was 46 when we was there, so it must have been about 47 because I came home in 48. That's right.
Where were you based in Palestine?
At a place called Castina. Yeah.
Where's that near?
It's, Tel Aviv's up the road, we called it up the road, but it were a few miles.